Hello, podcast listeners. This episode you're about to listen to is from the 2022 Be More Digital Conference. If you like what you hear, why not join us at the 2023 conference? It is going to be held on the 9th of March 2023 at the Novotel London West Hotel. We would just love to see you there. Visit charitydigital.org.uk for more information on all things digital. Enjoy.
Welcome back, everybody, to our second session of the afternoon. I'm very excited to introduce Sadie Crabtree. And I had a title here for Sadie called Head of Marketing and Platform, but I see that her real title is Head of Inspiration, which is obviously a much better title, which I want to steal. So Sadie is here from Prostate Cancer UK, and she has a brilliant case studies around user-centered design and how it helped Prostate Cancer UK win a first-of-its-kind charity partnership with NHS England. So over to you, Sadie.
Okay. Hi. How are you? Good? Cool. So this February, we launched the biggest public campaign in the history of our organization, directing men to take our 30-second prostate cancer risk checker. The media spend was funded by NHS England with the aim of recovering levels of prostate cancer referrals that had hit frightening lows during the pandemic. We believe there were 14,000 more men who had prostate cancer that needed treatment, but they didn't even know they had it. So during the campaign, more than half a million men used the risk checker. Nearly half of them learned that they were at higher risk and got facts about testing. And when the NHS data came out, we found out that we'd driven the highest level of referrals for urological cancer that the NHS had ever seen. And if you told me a few years ago that we were going to run a campaign that made that kind of impact, I'd have said, you must have us confused with another charity, because we had a really big problem and we had no idea how to deal with it. So the problem is that prostate cancer, which is the most common cancer in men, is a special challenge for public health campaigns. It clashes with what everyone thinks they already know about cancer. You go for screening, check yourself, feel for lumps, watch for symptoms, right? With prostate cancer, it usually has no symptoms when it's early enough to cure. You can't check yourself. You might be able to, but it's kind of a non-starter to suggest that you do. And it's the most common cancer with no screening program. Now, the reason that there is no screening program is because there's a test that isn't accurate or specific enough to use for blanket screening. So there are false positives that mean healthy men get biopsies that could cause infection. There are also some men who will discover cancers that are so slow-growing, they never would have hurt them, and they would have been better left alone. So even though we know that PSA testing saves lives, there's no consensus that getting more men tested is a good thing, looking across all men's health outcomes. Clinical standards say that men have to make their own informed decision about whether or not to have the test based on an understanding of their own risk. So to recap sort of how challenging this is for a public health campaign, if you imagine, this is our version of an awareness poster. Hey guys, listen up, okay? There's a big asterisk here because trans women and non-binary people get prostate cancer too. We have specific information for them, but our advertising says men because 99.9% of people who get prostate cancer are men. And a lot of them don't know what the prostate is or what it does or even who has one. This photo editor doesn't know where it is. He thinks it's down the front of his pants. So stuff like this doesn't help at all. There's a lot of confusion around who has a prostate. So we say, hey guys, listen up. There's a part of your body you might not know anything about that can kill you, and you might not have any symptoms to warn you. If you don't want it to kill you, you need to make an important decision about whether or not to have a test. This is really weird for you, because normally a doctor tells you whether to have a test, or a poster, or a letter, but your doctor can't give you the answer. And even people who know literally all there is to know in the world about prostate cancer can't tell you whether or not to have a test. No, you, who learned most of what you know about prostate cancer in the last 30 seconds, have to make this decision by yourself. Men, we are with you. So this is like, this just doesn't work at all. You can't make a public message out of the evidence-based clinical consensus on prostate cancer. But you can't not tell people about it either. So we'd run ourselves in circles over how to say something that was both clinically sound and simple and actionable. And this dilemma pushed us toward really lengthy messages about know your risk that didn't aim to influence behavior at all. These messages were designed around our challenge as we understood it, shaped like our own internal tensions and uncertainties, rather than being designed around an audience need and to a specific behavioral objective. Men didn't want to know their risk, and they didn't want to learn a mountain of facts about prostate cancer. They wanted to know what to do to avoid a terminal diagnosis. And that was really hard to articulate. But then the pandemic happened, and the NHS was overwhelmed, and people weren't going to their GP. So a lot of prostate cancer is detected incidentally, So someone's gone to their GP about something else, just gets picked up, they do a test. And these appointments weren't happening now. So referrals for suspected prostate cancer were in free fall. And pre-pandemic, there wasn't any agreement that more men getting tested would be a good thing. But now in the context of the pandemic, everyone could see that vastly fewer men getting tested was a bad thing. We knew this would result in more men dying from their cancer. And this coincided with work that the NHS was doing with their Help Us Help You campaign to get more people back into the healthcare system. But all of these focus on symptoms. This focus on symptoms meant that most men with early prostate cancer wouldn't be helped by these campaigns. So within the organization, a new objective emerged about restoring referrals for prostate cancer to pre-pandemic levels. And we had a new mandate from our leadership to help to figure out how to do that. And that's when we started developing the 30-second risk checker. So in the first year after we launched it, 200,000 men had taken it. NHS England had taken notice because while they were making progress on other cancer types, rebuilding the referral levels, the prostate cancer treatment gap kept growing. So over the summer of 2021, we started talking to NHS England to explore what we could do to shift behaviors at scale, which led to our campaign this year. It was funded by the NHS. £1.9 million media spend on these channels in this order, ran for 6 weeks, and the PR splash that we got right at the beginning of the first 8 days delivered 42% of the results. But that was only possible because we changed how we communicate about risk. So here's how we communicated about risk without the risk checker. There's no clear call to action. It's overly hedged, right? If you're worried, you might want to ask your GP, but only go if you're worried. We can't tell you if you should be worried or not. You know, here's a load of facts. It doesn't work as a soundbite. It's too complicated. So the risk checker is an interactive, shareable piece of content that could serve as a simple call to action for a major campaign. So we didn't have to say, here's all this information. We just say, take the risk checker, right? We built it using an off-the-shelf third-party platform so we could do it quickly and start learning from immediately. And here's what it looks like today. It asks your age, ethnicity, and family history, and it uses the answers to tailor the information that we provide to the individual based on their risk level. It's basically, it works like a chatbot. So it gives information about, based on your risk level, it gives you information about testing with the aim of providing enough information for men to make an informed decision, hopefully without overwhelming them. And because we anonymously store the answers around age, ethnicity, family history, we got immediate built-in insight about the impact of our content on different segments of the audience. So we can get continuous qualitative feedback from this question that we ask at the end. So we know what people decided after they learned about testing. We also, if they said, I haven't found this helpful, we ask them why, and we get to understand why. We could also reassure stakeholders that the right high-risk men were responding to our messages. We know if they are high-risk and low-risk because we have their answers. We know that they're getting the information they need because we can see that the rate at which they make the decision to have a test or not roughly matches what you'd see in a clinical setting. And finally, we could actually measure the impact of our effort to reach black men who have double the risk of prostate cancer. So unlike every other effort we made before to reach the audience, we knew exactly how many black men were engaging with this. So where we had no clear CTA, now we have one. We had long one-size-fits-all messages. Now we have messages tailored to risk level. And we were afraid that men would act without all the information that they needed, and also afraid that low-risk men would go for testing. Now we have analytics and feedback so we can see the impact, and we know more about what the impact is of that work. So looking at the actual product, the end product, it's just a chatbot. It's actually really simple. You know, you think I could make something like that in about an hour, and you could, but behind it is a lot of work that's shaped it over the last years to make it as effective as it is. So I'm going to tell a story about how we got from where we were to where we are now in the form of a series of tactics that we use to center our work on the user. I'm going to tell you what they are, when you might want to use them, and examples of what we learned from them. And I'm not going to try to give you everything you need to know. You can Google how to write a usability testing script and get half a dozen really great models. I'm not going to try to reinvent that wheel, but I'm going to focus on the learnings and principles I might have to add that you might not see somewhere else. And some of that's going to be about how to use these tactics to actually make your product better. And some of this is going to be about things you can do as a digital leader to influence within your teams and move your organization to a more digital approach to enable you to deliver that product. So first, I'm going to talk about our agile iterative approach. One of the most important concepts for digital products is this idea of iterative development. So you continuously create value for the customer from the earliest possible point, which is called a minimum viable product, or MVP. And then once you've created the product, you learn as you go. Instead of investing huge resources into planning a complex product and then finding out too late that no one wants it. But the way we developed health information services wasn't agile at all. It was very waterfall, very linear. The idea that we just give something a try and see what happened, it's not a thing. And likewise, our award-winning health information was reviewed on a two-year cycle consistent with the information standard. It wasn't something that we felt we could experiment with. So, but what allowed us to eventually take this approach and be more agile with how we did this was finding key opportunities to model digital ways of working within the services team. So when the pandemic happened in 2020, in March, and the first lockdown was announced, we didn't know how this was going to affect men with prostate cancer. All we knew was that people couldn't meet up in person anymore. And we had about 100-plus support groups that we have relationships with, and they'd all been meeting in person. So nobody knew what they were going to do, but we thought they might just stop. So I was head of digital at the time and worked with our support group's manager to provide paid Zoom accounts for every support group leader. And that was an easy way that we could immediately be there to try to encourage groups to keep supporting men through the pandemic and give them something really useful they needed. But the speed of delivery was not how the team was used to working, so there are a lot of worries. They're not going to know how to use it. We need to have a training program. What if we, you know, we need to define how the program works. A lot of questions. But they're really important questions, but they'd be much easier to figure out after we engage support group leaders instead of before. All we really needed to do in the first case was send an email around to all of them, offering them a free paid Zoom account, and ask how we could support them. So we managed to deliver value to the users really quickly, and we involved them in developing the product. So we got them directly involved. We had big meetings on Zoom with, you know, 50-plus support group leaders helping each other figure this out. So we kept improving it, but we were able to deliver that value immediately. So this experience of working in an agile way to get this MVP to customers and then improve it now existed within the organization as it relates to services. And that's so the takeaway is to find those opportunities, those key moments when it's low risk and high reward, and you can take an opportunity to show how iterative development can really get better results. So that's the agile approach. Second is we conducted message research. In 2020, when we first started trying to make an impact on referrals, we knew the messages that we had were not good enough to drive action. So we started with a round of message testing I conducted in-house using our own Insight Team's survey tool. We took three messages into testing. We took our sort of official line from a press release. We took my best crack at like a message that was designed to drive action, and we had kind of a compromise message somewhere between the two that we tried as well. There's a good way and a bad way to get feedback on messages from a survey. And one is to ask participants for their preference. You show them some messages and ask what's their favorite. That's the bad way. It's bad because people don't really understand how our brains work, so you're asking them to speculate. They don't know. And when you ask people to tell you about their mind, you're asking them to tell you about themselves. And that's about who they think they are, who they want to think they are. So the answers are clouded by their sense of identity and their values. You don't learn how people really respond. The other problem with asking for preferences is it doesn't give you any sense of how impactful the message is. It could be a really impactful message, or it could be just the one they hate the least. And you don't really see that when you ask for preference. The good way to do this is to measure outcomes. So you segment your audience. You expose the different segments to a different message. And then you measure how the segments are different because they saw the messages. So what we did is we did this in-house message testing. It cost less than £2,000. We had three messages, four segments. We had four segments because one of the segments saw no message at all. And then we asked questions like, what are the main risk factors for prostate cancer? What are the common symptoms? What should you do to protect yourself? These were multiple choice, and they had bad decoy answers, right? If you had no symptoms, how likely would you be to talk to your GP about your risk of prostate cancer? If you went to the GP, what would you expect to happen, right? And so because we had the three groups with different messages, we can directly show the different impact that they have. So here's what you can see from a survey like this, right? If you We've got the messages across the top, no message A, B, and C, and then down this way, we've got the different questions that we ask, and you can see the results. So if you look right here, you can see this is where people started. When they didn't have a message, we asked them this question. They didn't know what to do. Kind of a mix. Some of them said, I don't know. The others were just like, you know, you could throw darts at a board, and you'll get something like this. And most of them actually thought they should go for screening when the NHS tells them to, which is not going to happen because there's no screening program. If you look across this way, then you can see which message works best to increase the number of people who say the correct answer, that you should talk to your GP about the pros and cons of a test. And you can see the message C works best. So these are the raw percentages of the people who said that. If you look over here, we've also got this interpreted different one, which is the change from the baseline. So this is how much that message moved people from where they were initially. Did it move them up or down, right, in the response? And if you look down in terms of how many people say that they would call their GP, you can see that message C here is actually the most impactful in getting an increase in the number of people that would call their GP. But that one of the messages we were already using was actually making fewer people call their GP based on this research. So that was really interesting. These kind of numbers are really, really useful in explaining to people the importance of you know, really, really good messaging. And I want to say something about how we present the messages as well. So I'm going to show you a few different ways to share the same thing, because a lot of people don't really understand numbers very well or don't think in numbers. Some people are blessed to think in numbers and others don't. And the importance of really presenting this in a way that allows decision makers to make good decisions about it. So here is one result presented. Version A is 40%, version B is 48%. What's the difference between those numbers? I don't know, is it 8%? It looks like it's 8%, right? So one's higher. I kind of like message A better though, so why don't we stick with that? If you divide these numbers together, 48 divided by 40 is 120%. It's not 8%, it's 20%. So version B is 20% more effective. So when you start talking about how percentage more effective it is, you start to be able to imagine the actual impact of it. If you have a baseline of 30%, because you've done message testing in this way, you can only look at the increase. So now instead of 48 and 40, we're looking at 18 and 10. And you see that actually version B here was 80% more effective at increasing the response rate from the baseline. So this is an even better way to be able to talk about the impact of the message testing that you do. And my favorite way to talk about percentages is really not to talk about percentages at all, but to convert the ratios into the value unit of your stakeholders. And in the charity world, this is usually money or people. So don't tell me that it's 20% more effective. You can say that in a 2 million pound campaign, that's 400,000 pounds in added impact and 110,000 more people that we're gonna reach, right? So having, we convert that ratio into a tangible unit of value and it makes the decisions clearer for everybody. You might have your own reasons to prefer version A, but is it 400,000 pounds worth of reason? And having concrete results means you can translate that and make the decisions clearer. You can see what you're deciding between. And you can also do the opposite and show the negative. And you can frame doing nothing or not changing is not always a safe bet. It's an active decision that can have huge costs. So next is co-production. This is another tool we use to develop the content. It was, we did co-production and it was facilitated by our own staff. It was an in-person event, and we brought several clinicians together who specialized in prostate cancer, together with men at risk who didn't know much about prostate cancer at all. We started out by having the clinicians keep quiet and give the men at risk our top sit up and take notice message, 1 in 8 men get prostate cancer. And then we asked them what they wanted to know and why. They had no more information, they just told us what they wanted to know, and the clinicians listened. Then we probed why they wanted that. And after we'd explored that, we asked the clinicians what they thought the men actually needed to know about prostate cancer. And then we got to facilitate an extended conversation where we could see how men interpreted what they were saying and react to each other's perspectives on it. And This is a conversation about testing that normally happens in a GP visit under time pressure in a formal environment where information is mostly going one way. And now it's a whole room full of people talking to each other. So this is really valuable. We pulled out everything, the surprising that came up, the things people felt were really important. And then we used that as a starting point for the second part of the co-production exercise, where everybody sat together and collectively drafted content that would make the most sense to men and also satisfy the clinicians that men weren't making an informed decision. So they sat in the room and made the content. And it was brilliant because people in the room were often spoken for in our internal deliberations. So men will misunderstand this if we say this. Clinicians will think this if we say this. But we put them in the same room to attack the problem collectively. And that worked much better than making simulations of these people attack each other in an imagined proxy battle we waged in our own internal deliberations. And that helped us focus the rest checker on what men themselves wanted to know and incorporate the language that they used to talk about it. And it also really validated the whole the user need for this kind of content, which helped align the whole team around that need. In digital, we talk a lot about the user need for a product or feature. So being user-centric means understanding what they're after, what they're trying to accomplish, and focusing on delivering that as best we can. It's what the user says they need, not what you think they need. And in this case, what health experts generally think men need is to be aware of prostate cancer, understand their risk, understand the pros and cons of the PSA test so they can make an informed decision. But if you ask men what they need, it's much different. They say, how will I know? What should I do? It's very simple what I need. And so in this case, we can't give them everything we need because we don't have perfect answers, but understanding their needs helps us make something that's more valuable to them. And hearing directly from the men in co-production, it really helped align the team internally around that. Next is usability testing. Usability testing is where you get someone who's never used your website or app before, you sit them down at a computer, and you give them a task to do. Is this playing? I don't know why this isn't playing. There's videos in here that don't play, but it's okay. Imagine it. So you watch them do it. You record them so you can review it and share it with the rest of the team. As they do this, you ask them to think out loud and explain what they're trying to do, where they get stuck, anything that annoys them, anything that delights them, what they're thinking. This is really good for turning up navigational issues, interface frustrations, things you have no idea are a problem. Because when you're working on developing something, you're so close to the product that you know how it works and you can't see how real users are going to use it. It's really important to find that out. So there's different ways to do it. You can hire an agency to do it. You can do it in person yourself, or you can use an online service like this to do like an unmoderated usability testing where you set up a test, the user follows instructions, records their screen and their voice, and then you get this video that you can download. And you can even just go for a wander with a tablet and ask random strangers, give them a pin badge or something, and say, will you test my website? If you're an extrovert, this is a really easy and fun way to get started with usability testing. If you're not, it's really scary, but I like it. So moderated usability testing is usually better because you can probe more. If you see them do something, you're like, why'd you do that? They'll tell you, where you don't get that in unmoderated. Unmoderated is also usually lower quality because the people you get through the service are often people who do this as an income stream. So you'll see a lot of tabs at the top of their browser. You can see here they're on like a lot of different usability websites. And so you don't quite get the quality of feedback. It's a bit rushed. But with moderated usability testing, you can also brief your own team internally and your stakeholders to have them be involved in it, actually have them be moderators for the usability testing. And that lets people, you put people in the same room with the users, and it's really helpful in getting people aligned around what the users really want. So here's the thing we learned in our usability testing. So with version 2 of the risk checker, we added the ability for users to sign up for email from us, because it's really hard to watch 150,000 people go through your website, engaged in a campaign, and be clicking and clicking and doing all this stuff, and then just leave. So we said, okay, let's offer some of them the chance to stay involved. So we did it like this, right? So we didn't want to, we asked them if they wanted to opt in, but we didn't want to divert anyone. It's pretty much a linear journey here. We didn't want to divert anyone who was high risk and on their way to potentially making a decision about the PSA test and maybe calling their GP. So we only gave this to the low-risk segment, right? And we thought, okay, so you're going to find out you're lower risk. Well, we're not asking you to do anything. So what are you going to do? You might as well sign up for something. Nobody signed up, right? It's like 0.11%. It's nothing. Nobody signed up. When we put this in usability testing, we immediately could see what the problem was. Because everybody came to this because they care about their health. They were there to solve this problem which was prostate cancer and its potential impact on their life. Nobody perceived a low-risk result as a free pass to then be like, oh, okay, what do I do next? Everybody kept on the journey. They went to the website. They looked at the symptoms. Can I prevent it? What can I do? I want to know more. So the opt-in we have right that we have now is about 50 times higher. And there's a few reasons. But the main reason is that we built something that worked with the health-seeking, health information-seeking behavior and gave them easier access to what they wanted, but made it more likely that they would engage in opt-in. And what we did was we knew that one of the complaints people had was, you can't print this very easily. It doesn't look good when you print it. I can't take this home. If I go back to the website, I have to enter all the information again. There's no take-home. So give them a take-home email. Would you like an email with the information we've given you today, plus all these extra resources? And loads of people said yes, right? And once they say yes, we ask their email address. And once they give the email address, we ask them if they want to opt in. And they've already given us their email address and their name. So it becomes a one-click ask instead of a really involved ask, right? So we built this feature. It met users' need, and it also delivered value to the business in terms of being able to keep people engaged. Crucial to developing that is something I'm going to talk about also, which is also super useful, which is smoke testing. So developing a new feature like that, if you don't know if people are going to use it, developing a feature is really complicated and hard. We had to set up an API integration, get the data out, we had to pipe it into our email provider, we had to write all the emails, we had to do all this stuff. And if only a handful of people are going to use it, that's a waste. So smoke testing is where you validate the need for a feature by creating a non-functional test within the live product. So we just pretended we had the feature. You just say, do you want an email with this information? And if they say yes, you just apologize. Say, sorry, we can't. We're not doing that. But you are helping us, and we really appreciate you helping us make the risk checker better by telling us that this is what people want. Right? And so we did this, and then we found out that about 23% of people wanted the feature. And that was enough to decide that this was really valuable to offer. So that's another thing to point out with like kinds of like testing and things. Don't look at it as a referendum. 23% is 23% out of a quarter of the people that want the feature. It's not a vote, right? It's just a data point to go into your decision making. Another thing to say about being able to really quickly test things like this is a principle that I've added to my like agile ideology, which is don't argue over things you can find out the answer to. Okay, I try to never debate something that hinges on this. And an example is this email feature. So we went back and forth over how we're going to build the email feature. What was it going to do? Was it going to like remind people to call the GP? Or was it just going to provide information? And during those conversations, sometimes there was like, we would never do that. So why we shouldn't even test this, because we don't want to do it. Just because you don't want to do something doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't test if users want it. If you're only testing things that everyone already thinks are good ideas, you're not going to learn as much interesting things from it. And second, and this goes to this, I don't want to argue about what we should do if we don't know if users want it. I might have an idea. I accept my idea might be absolute crap, because maybe nobody wants it. And if nobody wants it, it's the wrong solution, right? So let's ask the users if they want it. If they don't want it, we don't have to have this argument. And this is a really like good time-saving maneuver that was really helpful in this. Here's another thing that we dipped in really quick. So you can learn stuff really fast if you have a lot of people going through a tool like this. You don't want to ask all the questions in the tool, because then you have this sort of hit to the usability of it, because people don't want to answer a lot of questions. But you can add a question once, right? You can add a question and leave it up for a day. So we have a lot of people, we talk a lot about, well, should we be targeting women? Because women can influence men's health decisions. And somebody suggested, well, we don't even know if all the people taking this thing are men. They might be women taking it for a man that they know and love. So we just ask. We just put this question in. And we put this question in, and then we found out. So it's mostly men. So 12% of them are women taking it for someone else. So we know now. So just go find out. Don't waste time in a lot of lengthy deliberations that you don't have to have. So split testing. Talk about split testing. You know what split testing is. You try two different versions of this, and you see how it works. With this, here's the thing that we also did to increase the opt-in rate. rather than just testing things before we launched, we took the launch as an opportunity to test. Because normally when you test, you have to wait ages for statistical significance to get enough results. We had so many people going through it. We were like, God, we can just test things and get answers really quickly. So we tried to different language for this opt-in. So version one is this one. So you can see this is what we say about ourselves. This we say, we are really great. We're smart and caring, and you know we love what we do. This is you should join us. We tested this against social proof language, which is a thing from behavioral science, which is about where you tell people what other people say about you. And in this case, we didn't tell them anything about how great we are. We just said, you know, 265,000 people have signed up to get news from us, and less than 4% unsubscribe. So this is really what you're thinking when you're trying to decide whether to sign up for something. Am I being suckered into signing up for this? They're going to send me a bunch of stuff that I hate. I'm going to have to unsubscribe. No, you're probably not. Most people don't. And that actually increased the opt-in rate for this particular thing by 33%, which is really cool. We also tried both of these together because, well, if both of them kind of work, maybe you know they'll work better together. They don't. This was 9.4% less effective than using just the social proof. So the things we did to impact the opt-in rate, by putting the info email first, 8 times more people opted in. Because we could then offer it to the high-risk people too, because it was a service that we were providing to them with the take-home email, we increased it by about 5x, changed the social proof language, increased it 30%. So all in all, we increased it about 50 times through the different things that we did. Last thing I'm going to talk about is funnel analysis. We looked at the number of people that make it through each step of the risk checker. So we just broke it into steps based on each engagement. So we look at the conversion rate for each step. So you just divide each number by the number above it. What percentage of people make it through this step, who arrive at this step? And now you can start to see where the problem is. And if you invert that, you subtract it from 100%, you can really see what the problem is, right? So step four, about double the people drop off at step four than any other step. So you see, okay, well, that may be true, but should we really focus on that step if we can improve any of those numbers? Well, there's reasons that you focus on the worst. You focus on the worst because if you're trying to increase 5% and you're trying to make an increase in an engagement where a very few people are getting through versus an engagement where a lot of people are getting through. If you focus on the worst interaction, it's easy because to make up that 5%, you're talking to all of those people who aren't currently converting and you're only trying to get a small number of them through, right? And it's very high impact. So that amount, because this funnel is multiplicative, just like marketing, that increases all the traffic that you have further down the funnel by 50%. Is easy and high impact. Focusing on the one that's already working pretty well is really hard because you can only convert, to improve that, you can only convert a very small number, and you have to convert almost all of them, and it doesn't make any difference because you increase that little bit, you've not really increased the traffic going down funnel. So that's why you focus on the worst. So we focused on the worst, and we went and we said, what is this worst? So the other reason is because it usually points you to something that's interesting. So what we saw here is the reason people weren't going farther. We were telling them about the PSA test, and then we needed to give them more information. They need to know this information to make a good decision. And we'd broken this up by inserting these engagements. So here, ask a question, we'll tell you more. Ask another question, we'll tell you more. The questions we picked were not questions that men would ask. So here, the question is, we've just told you there's a test for prostate cancer. What does it mean if my PSA is normal? Well, it means you probably don't have cancer. Like, that's really, nobody's gonna ask that. And people had to click on both of these to get all the information. So we were trying to be clever by making an interesting question here, but we ended up making it so that 34% of people were dropping off between these two engagements. We changed it to just something really basic, right? There's more information you need to know. Tell me more. Like, it's just more. Show me more. And 19% of people dropped off there. So that is a 24%, the change in that, because we made that one change, is that 24% more people who come through the risk checker are now fully informed about their risk. So if you go back to what we said earlier and how we present these numbers, that's 132,000 more men that if we do this campaign again are fully informed. That's £480,000 worth of added impact from that one change. right? If your goal is to get men fully informed so they can make a decision. So that becomes a one-sentence business case for more investment in this kind of work. Because if we can do this in an iterative way and we can learn things like this and make changes and improve the product, we can have impacts like that. And then before I stop, I want to say one more thing about bringing people around to a digital approach. And what really allowed us to develop the Risk Checker as an agile digital product is that our teams internally found new ways of working together. So when we first started building it, we really didn't know how to think about it. Is it a piece of health information that's owned by the health information team? Is it an online form owned by the website team? Is it part of a brand campaign, which is owned by comms? And we argued over what it was so we could decide who owned it and whose rules we had to follow to work on it. But it's not just any one of those things, right? It's all of those things. So we couldn't work on it in the same way we worked on health info. We couldn't treat it like a brand campaign. We couldn't treat it like a web form. Everybody had to let go a little bit of the way that we were used to working and figure out how we were going to do this new thing collaboratively. And that was really hard, and sometimes we got knocked backwards. It was frustrating, but it was really vital. And ultimately, we got there at the end by continuously putting the user at the center of the conversation.
What are you working on next?
We all want to know.
what I really want to do is so with this, there's going to be more. You're probably going to see more of this, but I can't say anything about what this might become. I'm really interested in how people we consider service users, eventually become supporters of the cause. So we know that like loads of people who now support the cause were service users. How do we identify all the touch points along that journey in a meaningful way where we can really map out this sort of long funnel of health engagement as well as cause engagement, and what are the levers at what point that we can do to encourage people along this journey to understanding that it not just as a disease but a cause, because I think there's a lot of tendency to see comms and marketing and fundraising as this one thing and as take and services is just giving, but actually being involved with the cause, we know for some of our most committed supporters, being involved with the cause is something that we give to them. This is a way that gives them a way to understand their relationship with the disease that puts them in control of things and not just like as someone that this disease is happening to. And how do we be more holistic in incorporating that into how we talk about things? That's what yeah.
Well,
so it's exciting me right now.
We'll look forward to seeing the results of that. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast and found this content helpful and would like to attend the 2023 Be More Digital Conference, you can purchase tickets through the charitydigital.org.uk website today.
We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.